Open Source relies on listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The Manchurian Candidate movie script. It's where the Donald Trump story has been trending for almost 2 years now. The wild notion in the Hollywood classic from 1962 that U.S. presidential politics could be taken hostage by a brainwashed pawn of Russian spy masters. In the movie, Lawrence Harvey played the shell of a man, Raymond Shaw, who, at the sight of a playing card, Queen of Hearts, will do anything he's told. Frank Sinatra played his pal from the army days, who's trying to snap Raymond back to sanity.
Why is all of this being done? What have they built you to do?
I don't know. I don't think anybody really knows except that it's over in Moscow. And my American operator here. Or whatever it is, it's supposed to happen soon. They can make me do anything, Ben. Can't they? Anything.
We'll see, kid. We'll see what they can do, and we'll see what we can do.
From the novelist Richard Condon and screenwriter George Axelrod, The Manchurian Candidate was thriller fiction, obviously. The suspicion after the Helsinki summit that a treasonous Donald Trump is the witting or unwitting stooge of Vladimir Putin is something else. A reading of circumstances, paranoid politics perhaps, but fiction has its own claim on authority. It is the lie that tells the truth, people have always said. It's the work of art and intuition and the imagination that gets to the point ahead of the plotting facts. So we're testing the lure of spy thriller fiction this hour. The power of the great fictionists to see where the game is going. And there have been giants in the medium, like Joseph Conrad, Eric Ambler, Tom Clancy, and the title holder in English for decades now, John le Carré. Robert Baer gets us started. He was a CIA field operator in the 1980s and 90s, mostly in the Middle East. George Clooney played the rough-and-tumble Robert Baer role in the hit movie Syriana in 2005. From Baer's first book, See No Evil. It's all about the evil underside of oil and arms trafficking, dynasties at risk, and drone assassinations in something like the Iraq War. You made fiction out of facts, Robert Baer, a storyline out of chaos in the news. What did your well-trained eye see at Helsinki? And welcome.
Well, you know, it's funny. It looks like bad fiction to me. There is no conceivable reason he would have a press conference like this, nor meet somebody he's accused of collaborating with, Vladimir Putin, without an aide president, without transcripts. Nobody knows what the deal is. Today it's come out he may have given away the eastern Ukraine. It's amazing. Inviting Putin to Washington, D.C. in a meeting with no agenda, with no progress, it's looking worse by the day. I mean, I think the man has either lost his mind, he's suffering from Alzheimer's, or he's a Russian asset. I've been looking into the Russian asset thing and talking to the KGB people that were in New York in the 80s, and they're telling me it's a little bit more complicated than that. What happened is 1986 was his first meeting with a KGB officer. Trump didn't know he was with the KGB. A guy named Antipov. He was the acting resident. So and eventually it comes around to inviting him to Moscow. The young woman is sent in to him and says, you make wonderful hotels and the Russians would do well if you came to Moscow and built one. And so off he goes to Moscow, little knowing that he's in touch with the KGB, and this is when they start observing him. And as you know, he comes back and puts advertisements in the newspaper saying, NATO's a bad deal, our defense alliance with Japan's a bad deal, we're wasting money, get out of NATO. You know, it's the same the same issue we're dealing with today, get out of NATO. Why should we defend Macedonia? Why should we invoke Article 5? The same article, by the way, the Europeans went to Afghanistan to aid us, but be that as it may. So, and what's really interesting with Trump is that he goes into business with the Russians, as we all know, in the 90s, when he runs out of money. He can't get credit, except with Deutsche Bank, some very shady loans. And all of his partners are Russians. And what few people know, that all these Russians, before they put money into Trump properties, got a green light from the Kremlin. That's the way Russia works.
Do we know that for sure? I mean, is that spy knowledge or public knowledge? We've known from his son for years that their money through the 90s was Russian.
What I know is from KGB officers. I talk to them all the time. And that these are defectors. They're exiles. Are they 100% reliable? No. But they tell a consistent story that if you have $50, $100 million and you want to put it in the United States of Russian money, you cannot do it without the Kremlin's permission. You know, if you're a small guy, that's fine. So you look at Trump Toronto, the tower there that he built,
right.
His partner is essentially the Russian government, the VE Bank. This is a very good article.
The FT, and, you led me to it. It's marvelous.
Yeah, and who signed the loan was Vladimir Putin. So Trump goes to Helsinki, and he's seeing his creditor, you know? It's like I deal with my banker. I'm very polite to him. And if he asks me to do something, I usually do it if I want any more money or I want to refinance. So much of this stuff is in the open, and nobody is really connecting the dots.
Robert Baer, just keeping track here, you're saying from the beginning the Russians were playing him, going back to 1986. Come out of Moscow and even imagine that you'll build a big Trump hotel here.
They were never going to build the Trump hotel. That was a come on. They were looking for someone to replace Armin Hammer, the chairman of Oxy, who was a fellow
Occidental
traveler.
Petroleum, right?
He was a fellow traveler. The FBI knew he was being cultivated by the KGB. Reagan was his friend. The FBI goes to Reagan and said, look, the guy we think is a Russian agent of influence, don't see him anymore. And Reagan didn't. And so Trump was the replacement for an ailing Armin Hammer. And that's pretty much the way it went. And this is what I'm hearing from KGB officers that are all over the United States, and they tell a consistent story.
My impression is that all you ex-security guys, probably MI6 too, and the Mossad maybe, drink at the same lodge, or is that plausible?
We do. You never give it up. We hang out together. It's completely boring, and it's no fun hanging out with us.
Spying is waiting, as the man said, and very boring. But you say bad fiction, Robert Baer. Who made it up?
They didn't make it. Look, Trump is not the Manchurian candidate. They had no idea that we would have a populist revolution in this country, and he would ride that wave. He was cultivated as a force of disruption. I don't know that he became a birther at the behest of the KGB or a Russian.
Is Vladimir Putin a birther? There's the question.
Well, he makes things up. I mean, he's a fantasist. I mean, he's crazy. I mean, and they get along. So we have a very nuanced, subtle situation here. And what it comes down to, I think, and I'm still investigating this, is if the Russians called the note on the Trump property empire, it would collapse.
Robert Baer, it's one of your rules of spycraft that you look for ghosts. What does that mean in this situation as you're watching the Helsinki press conference?
I'm looking for motivations. I'm looking for a politician. And you suspect the worst. When I have a conversation with an FBI agent, he looks at me and said, that is not evidence. I can't go into court and get a conviction. But I'm not looking for convictions. I'm looking for the bad apple in the barrel. And I'm using intuition, and I'm simply in my mind taking the data points and adding them up. One point alone doesn't tell you the story, but you talk to Russians, you talk to FBI agents in New York, and you pick up a piece of the story Could I take this to court and get a conviction? No. But, you know, look at this woman, this Siberian woman that was run into the
NRA.
Tell
us about it. Yeah, please.
That was a classic operation. I mean, that's happened to me. I remember we went out to, and we're dealing with the KGB, my boss and I, and we had the director's airplane, and we started in the morning, really at 9 o'clock in the morning, drinking vodka. And by 10 o'clock at night, we were at a dinner, and my boss and I are, you know, finishing dinner, more vodka. We probably had a couple bottles apiece. And now the KGB liaison guy turns to us and said, now it's time to enjoy ourselves as men. We go, what? And these two girls come out. Now, we're in official visit to Russia, both of us. And my boss, he was funny. He says, you know, I spent 32 years in the CIA, and this never happened to me. We just got up and left, politely left. But this is what they, a honeypot operations. And they take this girl, if you know, she wasn't absolutely gorgeous, but pretty enough, and run her into the NRA, National Prayer Breakfast, and start spotting unwitting sources of, you know, influence, covert action, and this is what she was doing. It's a pattern, and they do it all the time, and it worked. I mean, the FBI didn't arrest her because they just wanted to cause problems. They have evidence on her that she was run into the NRA and to the president.
Robert Barry, you say, could you take this to court and get a conviction? Maybe not. Real question is, could you take it to Hollywood and get a blockbuster? Or could you, even better, write a novel that would tell a story of our time? That's our thought this hour, that the test is, does it stand up as fiction?
Oh, absolutely, it stands up as fiction. This is fiction. This is the Manchurian Candidate. I could add some details, but it's a good writer that could make this story come alive. I mean, I was just a bureaucrat. I'm not a writer. But you could take a writer and you could, you know, add the emotion, the complexities, the fights, the doubts, and the rest of it. And you could, a Tolstoy could tell this story brilliantly.
He sure could, and we could come back to him. He anticipated, I think, spy fiction, even in War and Peace, and we're going to talk about it. Robert Baer gets this hour started. We are reimagining the Helsinki scene as grist for the spy-fi mills that are grinding in Moscow, too, and in Beijing as well. This is Open Source. The premise is that it takes the mind of fiction, a make-it-up imagination, to see what was going on at the Helsinki so-called summit. Richard Lurie is a Boston-based Russianologist who had the nerve and the verve to compose the late dictator Joseph Stalin's autobiography. I asked him to read Helsinki for us.
The thing that impressed me was twofold. One is, Putin comes out the successful alpha male. He kept Trump waiting for almost an hour. He had the strut. He was beaming the charisma. Trump looked rumpled and vague, and his answers were rambly, but they always are. But then I thought about it a little bit more, and I said, you know, in some ways, these two guys are more alike. They put a lot of stress on, you know, who wins the moment, who wins the show, who looks the strongest, the toughest, the badass. But in fact, Putin goes home with nothing to speak of except sort of the afterglow. And yes, he's been given a seat back at the table of the civilized nations, which was a mistake. But what he needs more than anything is money. And the only way for him to get that money is for the sanctions to be lifted. We don't know what the deal was made. I have a sense of what the deal was behind the scenes. But if it wasn't to lift the sanctions, he goes home to a very serious situation where the pension age has to be raised by 5 years for men, which means in some places guys are going to die at work because the life expectancy is less than the new pension age.
Wow.
The oligarchs are turning on him because they're losing money and they can't use their private jets anymore because they can't get service or parts because of the sanctions.
That'll annoy an oligarch.
Yeah. And this is, again, the diminution of power. It's a very alpha male thing. The Russians are typically represented by a bear. That's the symbolic, totemic animal for Russia. But there's really another animal that counts, which is the wolf. It's a very Russian animal. And, and the wolves run in pack, and the leader of the pack keeps his dominance by various moves, nipping, biting, snarling, and doing all those things. And I see Putin much more as the leader of the pack, the leader of the wolf pack. And the leader of the wolf pack knows that he's out in front, but behind him there's some very badass wolves. And there's got to be one of those wolves who's thinking, hey, I could do the job just as good as this guy, especially now when he's costing us all money. He won, and yet I think he's a nervous man.
So write the next movie scene, the critical movie scene in the adventures of Vladimir Putin.
Well, he goes back to Russia, and some other weird event happens, like the poisoning of that agent in England. Maybe it's a poisoning of an agent in the United States. And it's clearly something that Putin would not have ordered at this time. And so it's an indication to Putin and to the world that you have a serious enemy out there. Maybe it's some officers in the military intelligence who have access to those kind of special nerve agents. Maybe it's those people in cahoots with some oligarchs who are putting up some money and hoping for a reshuffling in which they'll be getting a better deal. And that tells us that, in fact, there's an undercover civil war behind the scenes in the Kremlin or in Moscow. That's one scene.
Our guest, David Filipov, came home this year from a long stint in Moscow as the bureau chief of the Washington Post. He now edits The News at Northeastern University. You just heard Richard Lurie, David, and Robert Baer before that. What do you suppose the mind of Moscow is making of their man, Putin?
Okay, so ordinary Russians think this whole thing is crazy. Americans are out of their minds. Why are they still picking on us? Most people respect Putin for what he does. They don't really particularly like him, and they don't particularly think he's answering their interests. But he's made this narrative that I'm defending Russia from outside influence, outside efforts to hem us in, right? So when Putin stands shoulder to shoulder with the president of the United States, it sends that signal that I, Putin, can stand in the face of sanctions and Europe trying to keep us out, and the Democrats who hate Russia, and I can stand next to the most important person in the world as an equal. That's all he needs for this show. But Richard Lurie, he makes a very good point that the Putin regime is based on him picking and choosing the people who are going to be his power, the people who are going to handle the money. Richard Baer made a very good point, too, that the money moves only with Putin's consent. He weeds out the oligarchs who don't suit his purposes. He's constantly trimming the government of the people who get in the way and might pose a threat. But at the same time, he depends on these people because they've got the money and they move it around. So for him, it's a very nervous game. There's the one hand, what he shows to the Russian people so that he can show that I'm a legitimate leader. And there's the other hand, what goes on in the Kremlin. And there's one last thing I want to say about this scene, because this is the one we don't see. And this is the one, you know, every Russian knows that this is how it works. And it's so hard here to get that view if you haven't been there and you haven't seen. They meet in the room, the Putin insiders. And he says, okay, we got to do this. And the insiders say, yeah, boss, whatever you say. All right, somebody go and invent a trolling agency that's going to mess with them. Yeah, sure. And then that guy goes off and does his thing. He may do it the way that Putin wants. He may not. It may get out of control. Someone else says, all right, go meet with these bankers and try to bend them. See if we can pay them some money, get them to work for us. Sure, boss. And then it goes off and maybe it works and maybe it doesn't. It's this chaotic use of these private contractors, insiders, that creates Russian policy. And that's why Putin can look you in the eye, as he did on that interview, I think it was CBS, and say Russia as a state has never meddled, because Russia as a state hasn't. It's these contractors, these players, these people like that banker who's behind the NRA woman, who basically play the role of the ambassador. They're not state actors. They're private businessmen who just happened to be meeting and happened to be giving you like $30 million.
So many odd notes here, David. One of them, on state television in Moscow yesterday, I just happened to see, the anchor lady says, as translated, when Trump says our relations are bad because of American foolishness and stupidity, he really smells like an agent of the Kremlin. What does that mean?
I know that person. I know her well. And she makes a joke all the time out of this. Another one of her favorite lines is, so Trump really is ours. She's trolling us. She basically says that because she knows that there's going to be this hue and cry in the West. They love it. It's great theater. It's great theater for their TV shows to show the Americans out of control, our chaos, our democracy is a mess. And that was the goal of this whole thing. Show America to be not better than us. And that's why Donald Trump fits with Vladimir Putin, because he says, we're not better than anyone else. We kill people, too. We also go back on our agreements. We have no moral superiority. That message, they love that in Russia.
We're talking about the fiction that will come out of this whole scene sooner or later. I want to introduce Olin Steinhauer, who joins us from New York. He's a rising star in Spy-Fi, author of five novels set in Ukraine, decade by decade since the 1940s. The third season of his video series, Berlin Station, begins this fall on Epix Cable. Olin, what did you make of all this? As a fictionist, too.
Yeah, well, as a fictionist, I mean, Bob Baer called it bad fiction, and that really hit home for me. And I was trying to think why, and it's because, like, when you're writing fiction, at least when I write fiction, I know a big purpose is to find empathy. And so, like you said, my first five books took place in the Ukraine, and it was because I was interested in the other side. I wanted to understand the other side of the Cold War. And so when you look at Putin, you think, okay, what's going on in his mind? What's going on in Trump's mind? And what was so baffling about this and why it was bad fiction was that it made no sense to me why Trump was acting the way he was in front of the cameras with Putin. If, let's say, he is a puppet of Putin, they're both adults. They know that he has to put up a good face, and he didn't do that. It's not like Putin would suddenly get angry at him and pull in all of his loans.
Can I question the whole puppet story, which I introduced with Manchurian Candidate? Do we believe that there are puppets here? And let's assume that they've been playing Trump for a long time with loans and this and that. They couldn't have had any notion, any more than you did or I, that he would be president or a candidate anytime. But furthermore, I wonder how much more do they know about Donald Trump than Google knows about me or you, for example? I mean, why do we leap to say pawn when we know that everybody's transparent now?
Right. Well, I mean, if someone, pawn is probably too strong of a word, but if you have someone, you have some sort of influence over him. And, one big question is, why has he never released his tax returns? That's something everyone sort of forgot about. People are starting to remember again. And as Bob was talking about, all of his empire's money or a large chunk of it has come from Russia. And so it makes sense that Russia has some sort of power. All creditors have some power over you. It doesn't have to be quite as insidious as we like to make it. But there has to be something.
Maybe that's a question for you, Bob Baer. Do we want to refine or qualify this sense of puppetry here?
Well, what disturbs me is that Trump, over the last year, has been a wrecking ball to the Atlantic Alliance. He's gone after Canada, the EU, the G7. Mm-hmm. Everything in that list is to the benefit of Vladimir Putin. I understand he's a populist, but you go right down the list, and the one person he won't condemn is Vladimir Putin. And that's what disturbs me. That's what we have.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
And then you have all these desperate attempts to get a back channel to the Russians after the elections, a direct back channel. You had the meeting in Trump Tower with Jared and Manafort. How did Manafort, I understand what's come out in the press, end up as his campaign chairman? Manafort was, in effect, a KGB agent. He was working with two SBU officers, those are local Ukrainian officers, who flew back after each meeting to Moscow to report to the KGB. They were always. So you've got all this. It's not Chinese stuff. It's all Russian. And, meetings in the White House with Kislyak, the ambassador, and it goes on and on and on. And as far as assessing the man, really understanding what's inside of him, you have all those New York businessmen, Arifov that was a Trump Soho, a KGB agent, and you go right down the line. All of those people are calling back and saying, look, this guy, well, number one, he's going to protect your money because you can put it into his companies with an LLC. He's not going to ask where the money came from. The fact is, most of the money, the Russian money that came in, was stolen early on from the Communist Party. They didn't want Yeltsin and the reformers to get a hold of it. And a lot of it was state assets. You look at Trump Tower in Toronto, and you know, as the article says, it came from the sale of something in the eastern Ukraine, a steel factory. So they are on this guy all the time. And Russians are running through a couple floors down. There's a Russian mobster living there, and they see him all the time. They know who he is.
I want to go back to your original thought, though, on the Atlantic Alliance. You don't have to be a stooge of the Russians to think that the Cold War is over and that NATO needs to be, you know, embalmed or freshened up in some fundamental way. David Filipov, I think you're onto that same notion.
That's right. And it's even more than that. Trump, let's forget for a moment, because everybody, Bob Barr makes a great point about Putin and how he might be beholden to his creditors. But at the same time, when he strikes that note, hey, Putin's a tough guy like me, and these French and German and Canadians, they're nothing like us. Do the people who vote for him disagree with him on that? Do Americans who see Putin ride around on that thing, do they think he's cool? I mean, do Americans who don't have passports, don't travel abroad, don't see the difference between Russia and France really care? But if Trump says, hey, the liberal, you know, media that screwed everything up all these years and made enemies of Korea and China and Russia, they're against this. I'm doing it. It's good. We should be doing it. Do his people, his supporters here, have any evidence that what he did in Helsinki in some way or another hurts them? I say they don't. And when he says France and Canada are foes, why should these people disagree with him? Until, of course, they start feeling this trade war in their pockets. But until that day, why shouldn't they believe? And why isn't Trump playing actually an excellent game for himself? Hey, look, I'm with Putin. He's a reasonable guy. Why are all these people like Hillary and Obama against him? They're wrong. Fake media is in on it, so they're wrong too. Everybody's wrong. Listen to me. I know what I'm doing.
Olin Steinhauer, mediate this question of who's playing whom here.
Well, this is, I mean, what actually David's question is very interesting about what do the Trump supporters think. I was curious about that myself, and I was looking on Twitter, and I kept, and this thing that seems so damning to most of us, this private two-hour meeting, is a boon to the Trump supporter. They tend to say, okay, yeah, he didn't perform that well in front of the cameras, but we don't know what happened in that secret meeting. We know that he was strong there and he was looking out for America's interests. Yet for some reason, that didn't appear on the camera. And it's this, you can look at one thing and see it two completely different ways, which is actually at the root of all sort of espionage fiction. You see one thing, you know what it means, and then you discover by the end of the book, oh, it meant the opposite.
So parse this word that has new life in American journalism, treason. and maybe that's for you, Bob Baer, but I mean, Tom Friedman is charging him with treason.
Well, if it's betrayal, yes. Look, offering to give up, even the idea of giving up our ambassador, sending him to Moscow, even countenancing it for a second, I tell you, as a former CIA officer, it's betrayal. Because if you're going to send that ambassador back to Moscow to face Russian law, why not send a U.S. soldier back to Afghanistan or Iraq to face local law? That's the way I look at it. And for the President of the United States to take the side of Putin over and over again against the CIA, the FBI, and the National Security Agency, when the intelligence is absolutely brilliant on military intelligence hacking and meddling in our election, that is betrayal. And when I use the word treason, that's the sense. Now, I know it's not a time of war, but he's giving aid and comfort to an adversary. And I realize, and I'm absolutely positive, you know, but I'd like to just continue. I'm absolutely positive that Trump supporters are looking at this like he's a strong leader, cutting a deal with Putin, but they're not paying attention that he killed somebody in Britain with a fourth-generation nerve agent, which has never happened before, and cutting Britain and Canada loose is a betrayal of the Atlantic Alliance. And even in their terms, it's treason.
David Filipov.
All right, I have the twist ending because we're all saying the same thing and we're all incredulous. And like a good Hollywood movie, we go along thinking, this is truly that story. This is the story of how an American president was bought. And, you know, our heroes, Chris Pratt and Jennifer Lawrence, go to Ukraine and then they discover a horrifying secret. And as it unfolds, they feel the pressure as Trump men come after them. See, it was Trump who went to Putin and said, I know how you can hide all that ill-begotten money, but you've got to do this thing for me. I need you to create troll farms that will then compromise the Democratic Party and bring me to power. And if you do all these things, I'll help you out. And that's what they discovered, that it was actually Trump's. And that's how it fooled all of us. Why is he doing this? Why is he betraying his country? Because it was his idea. Now, that's my fiction. That's
but
not
I
want
to. I want to push back on Bob Baer.
It would be a good movie.
But you're sounding like a CIA guy more than a fictionist, and in even in praising the brilliance of this kind of intelligence, if the national security intelligence is so damn good, as Trump wants us to reflect, why have we been fighting unwinnable wars for 50 years, including Vietnam? I mean, what's so great about that kind of institutional power?
Well, I'm looking at the indictment. They got a lot of this stuff off of intercepts on those 12 GRU officers, mm-hmm. and you just read that thing carefully. Now, people are going to say, well, look at Iraq. Well, I was part of Iraqi operation, and that was all fabricated at the behest of the White House. They scraped the barrel. We had assets that said, no, we got rid of his WMD, but the Bush administration said, no, we're going to war anyhow. Give us, give us some evidence or whatever. And so we went to trashy agents, and that was known in the CIA. There was a full-on revolt among analysts saying, no, we don't have the goods.
We're talking about spying and spy fiction, aspiring to the wisdom of the best spy fiction on open source. We're also talking the limits of spy fiction compared to the limits of state intelligence. This is Open Source. We're talking about spy fiction and how Helsinki might read in the hands of a master. With Robert Baer on the line, late of the CIA and the movie fame for Syriana. There are spy fiction minds in China, too, that are sketching plot lines in and around what they saw in Helsinki. Adam Brooks wrote the thrillers Night Heron, another one called Spy Games. He's an American schooled in the UK who spent years reporting from China long enough to imagine a Chinese take on that summit.
A Chinese intelligence report coming out of Moscow in Helsinki is going to be completely preoccupied with the notion that what we just saw is a raw exercise of power channeled between two men, between two individuals, articulated in body language and emotion. And what that really stands for, what that signifies in the mind of this intelligence operative, is the degree to which the American global presence, the ability of America to make itself felt on the world stage, to exercise its power and influence, is dying. It's fading away. It's senile. It's senescent. We're seeing a younger, smarter, pragmatic, and kind of carnivorous new Russian power take on an older version of power. And we're seeing this sort of older, senescent power almost kind of shrug and give up. It's like the older man doesn't even want to fight anymore. It's like an abrogation of power, an abrogation of responsibility. And it's channeled at the level of personal power and personal interaction and character, not at the levels of institutions and rules and norms.
The Chinese are going to have a very different view, too, of background culture, modern history, mythology, self-imagery, military history. They're also going to be looking at money in a way that our reporting doesn't much. International flows of capital that both of these dudes are floating on.
The Chinese elite know the back roads of international finance very, very well indeed. The Shell Company, the shell company within the shell company, the tax haven, the back routes, the ways of getting money out of China, getting it to Hong Kong, getting it into Hong Kong dollars, getting it through a casino, getting it laundered through a consulting company, getting it out to the British Virgin Islands or the Cook Islands or somewhere, you know. This stuff is very familiar to the elites of China. They'll be framing and considering the actions of the Russian elite with a measure of familiarity that we simply don't have.
That was Adam Brooks. Robert Baer, let's call that an English-American-Canadian imagining of what China might be seeing it at Helsinki. What do you make of it?
I agree. Look, the Chinese, frankly, I have a lot of respect for their intelligence service, especially of late. They understand us, and they're very focused on what interests them, and that's, of course, Japan and North Korea and American technology and shutting down the CIA in China, which they've managed to do. There's just been one scandal after another, and they're sitting back, but the Chinese are still sort of amazed by American culture, the irrationality of it, and the brilliance of American culture and the incompetence of our government. And let's not forget, they are plugged into Washington. They stole, our federal employment lists. They hacked it. But they would dare come after us politically and support a politician or attempt to run some sort of extensive covert action like the Russians have with this Russian woman or anything else, or appeal to the NRA or the far right or the rest of it. That's too risky for them. And I do believe this is going to blow back on Russia when the full extent of this scandal comes out and more indictments and the rest of it. And that's a risk the Chinese would never take. They'll be happy to get our missile technology and the rest of it and that'll do just well for them.
Stand by, Robert Baer and Olin Steinhauer. One more round of quick fiction reading Helsinki. Dan Vesperman won the Ian Fleming Steel Dagger Award for thriller fiction 15 years ago for his second novel titled The Small Boat of Great Sorrows. And what, I asked him, might he spin instantly out of the news this week from Helsinki?
Well, whenever I'm stitching together a diabolical plot, I like to include enough threads of truth to make the whole thing feel plausible. And my favorite obscure news item that I've seen recently that I kind of would build this thing around was an account of a meeting held just before Trump's inauguration, way out in the Indian Ocean in the island nation of the Seychelles. Now, this was a meeting of Russian financiers and government types, a crown prince from one of the Gulf states, representatives from Israel and Saudi Arabia, and the special American guest was none other than Eric Prince, the founder of Blackwater Security, who had been secretly advising Trump, and who also happens to be the brother of Education Secretary Betsy DeVos.
There's your cast.
Yeah, and so there's your exotic tropical locale for your opening scene with this shady meeting at which the whole plot, years in the making, is finally coming together just as the man is about to take the oath. From there, we flash back, say, 14 years or so to find Trump on the verge of yet another bankruptcy and his casino biz is bottoming out yet again, and the New York tabloids are dismissing him as a spent force and he's on the verge of financial ruin. And here comes his friends, the Russians, with promises of loans and of overly generous purchases of his failing real estate properties and so on, as long as he'll always do their bidding. And at this point, Trump himself has no idea of what their long-range plans for him are. And that will include a slow and steady rebuilding of his image and his prominence, which they began in 2004 by using their investment leverage in the entertainment industry to land him his gig on The Apprentice, which begins his celebrity makeover, and they even coach him on the most telegenic way to say, you're fired.
All Russia all the way. Does he know the web he's in?
He knows the Russians are bailing him out. He doesn't know what they're building him toward. Along about this time, they also decide they need to plant someone in his inner circle to keep tabs on him, and for that job, they recruit a bombshell model named Melania with East Bloc roots in Slovenia. And, with sex being Trump's weak spot, it works like a charm. And by early 2005, they're married. And so they've got their mole. And by the way, that infamous jacket she wore a few weeks ago with a message, I really don't care, do you? Well, that was a coded statement in advance of the Helsinki summit to let Putin know that he had nothing to worry about and that the Donald would be as obliging as a lapdog when it came time to face the world's press.
Wow.
She's a double agent, and she's just keeping him honest along the way, or as honest as you can keep someone like Donald Trump.
That's Dan Pespisen. David Filipov, is that possible?
That's an excellent. Melania
is the spy. Donald Trump is the arm candy.
This is an excellent theory, but there's one thing that's behind all this, which is also part and parcel of a movie. This is Russia's high watermark. Vladimir Putin knows he can't stay in power forever. When he's gone, this charismatic leader is gone. The Russian oligarchy can't get its money around. That's a law that the supermajority passed. Donald Trump can't reverse that law. Russian society is suffering brain drain. There's a whole problem of the aging of the country and the lack of pensions. We're looking at the moment when right now Russia is saying, or Russia power is saying, yeah, we got them. But what we talked about with China, that made more sense. This idea of infiltrating the economic model, of playing the Americans at the game that they can play, rather than making this brilliant, you know, political ploy to get some influence on the United States. The Chinese model will work. The Russian model is going to run dry, and it's going to end when Putin, who's using this stuff to stay in power, is no longer in power. Who's going to take over? I believe that we're at the high watermark of Russia's influence on this thing. I believe that China is actually the one that's going to be scripting the next spy movies for the next, you know, 30, 40 years. Olin, as much as I appreciated Olin's thing, I thought it was brilliant, I would go to that film.
Olin, make art of this sordid political story. Take it beyond the personalities.
I like the desperation of Russia, because, I mean, one of the things that we often sort of forget is because we're talking about these ridiculously wealthy oligarchs. But the Russian, GDP, it's smaller than Texas. And that's something that I think sort of people forget. And they have this enormous population. And it's not really sustainable, particularly when all the money is going into a few pockets. And I'd written a couple of novels that focused on the Chinese, too, because their methodology was so sort of careful and intelligent. The Russians always came across as more blunt instruments, to my mind, which in a way this sort of works with the 2016 election. All these Facebook posts are like a number of blunt hammers just being thrown and thrown, and what's going to stick? And, you know, I really love Dan's novel that he was spelling out right there. And I know I couldn't do any better than that with tying in Melania. But people start to get, like with Melania, she's someone who's easy to ignore. But that jacket, that famous jacket, I was reading that it apparently comes from an Italian fascist slogan from Mussolini's time. That's gotten revamped in with contemporary Italian fascists. That's interesting.
Robert Baer, let's go very, very wide in this story. You mentioned Tolstoy, and I was thinking War and Peace. Why? Because the critical moment when Moscow is panicking about Napoleon on the march, General Kutuzov says, in effect, don't worry. You know, patience and time and snow will destroy this man. And Russia will survive. That's what great novels and great fiction does for us. What's the larger truth coming out of this story? And I have a couple of notions.
I'm pessimistic. I've got to say this. I deal with people that are part of the Trump cult, and I call it a cult because facts don't matter. For them, facts are accusations. I have never seen this country, people at each other's throat like they are now. With this whole idea of undermining the media, I think it's the most corrosive attack on the United States in the election of Trump. Whatever his connection to the KGB is, has divided this country. It's going to take us a very long time to get over. And I agree with everything that people have said. I think that Putin's going to lose this. The country is going to go under at some point. This, you know, the haves and the have-nots there.
His country, yeah.
It's a quick tactical victory. But nonetheless, it's going to do us enormous long-term advantage. unless we all sit down, including this administration, and deal with the facts. And, you know, we've got to lighten up here and just say, look, we were attacked. Trump's president. Let's make sure it doesn't happen again. And if they go into the 2018 elections or 2020 with the same, you know, gunnery, it's going to be that much worse.
Talk back to my general notion that one of the things I'm learning here is that Russophobia, which is the first sort of panic button in our politics, is not what it used to be. Here's a populist president saying, you know, they're just people, and as we say, their economy is a fragment of ours. They're not pointing anything at us. Let's get on with history. Is that naive?
Yeah, it's naive because, I mean, it's a dangerous power. It's sitting on Europe. You know, if he does unstitch NATO, the world is going to change. And you have all these other proto-fascists which are supported by Russia, from Austria to Italy to Hungary to Poland. Even in France, these people have not gone away, and it's going to change a security arrangement we had in Europe, and the rest of the world is not going to be the same. We are not going to spring back to what we were. A depression. What's it going to do to this country if the tariffs, $200 billion, are really charged against China? It will lead to an economic, very deep recession or worse, and that is going to have a huge effect on our politics. So, you know, it's a cascading effect, electing a populist, and there's a good argument that they're hacking and meddling. Put this guy in the office. We'll never know for sure, but there's a very good argument they did.
Robert Baer, you're marvelous. David Filipov, Go Fictionist, the big picture here, the story to remember.
The story to remember is that we did this to ourselves. The fact that enemy of the people, which is what you are, Soviet slogan, and it sticks so well in America.
He invented it, right?
Stalinist slogan, and it sticks so well. The idea that the media is fake and everything is wrong and there are no facts
bad,
and
bad,
there's
bad.
No American exceptionalism. This is all stuff that people voted for, not because Russians told them. They voted for 25 million Americans. Can't be wrong. It works on us. And this is Putin's greatest victory, is that we turn out to be such easy marks. That's not fiction. That's real. And, you know, if 50% of the American public doesn't show up to vote, Trump would win again today, even with all this stuff. That's not fiction. That's real. What is really amazing reality is that this stuff works on us, that we really don't care about the liberal world order and American exceptionalism. We seem to care more about, you know, slogans and name calling and libtards and all of that stuff. And Putin sits back. And in the last scene of, I think, Dan's version, he's just sitting back in a dark room cackling. And behind him, Russia's falling apart. It doesn't matter. It works on us. That's the crazy thing. Russian trolls might have swung a few thousand votes here and there. 25 million people bought this stuff. And that came from home, man. It was in the dust like the vampire movies.
Is there any opinion we haven't heard this hour? Do we need Olin to give us one more before
I would throw in a small thing. I mean, one thing is that we look at Russia as the big bad bear that's looking just to rip us apart. But the Russians have some reason to feel angry at us, angry at the West. They had high hopes in 1989, 90, 91, and I can't say that the West did a lot to sort of help them into democracy during the 90s. I think
H.W. Bush missed an opportunity there. Yes.
Yeah. And so it's true. And I think this is something we're paying for now.
Also, we made a mistake in pushing NATO to the borders of Russia.
Right.
And when we talk about the liberal world order, you know, being threatened, it hasn't been a great bargain in the last 30, 40 years. Not since Vietnam.
No.
Anyway, I want to strike a hopeful note. it comes down to pessimists and optimists in the end anyway. But, I mean, I think Donald Trump was not elected by Vladimir Putin or hatred of the press or a lot of other bad things. He was elected in response to too many Clintons, too many Bushes, and too much war in the Middle East. Story to be continued, but thank you all. Thank you, David Filipov. Thank you, Robert Baer and Olin Steinhauer. Also, Richard Lurie, Dan Festerman, and Adam Brooks. Special thanks to our man under deep cover at PRX, John Barth. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Homa Sarabi Doné, and the artist Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our KGB. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.